Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
What's going on, dude? That's one hell of a profile picture you've got there. I almost want to just say, just click that on for the whole interview.
I can do that. Hold on. I usually have it.
Let's see it. I've got my,
is the bed. I've got this live, you know, Peter Doig background, but.
Well, I mean, it's obviously way better seeing you, but let's.
Fat Beatles.
Is that what that is? Incredible.
Yeah.
And I mean, so at the top right there, who I know that's Paul at the top left. Who's that top right?
That's Ringo.
Incredible. Paul. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll try to find the image so you can actually
so
see
good.
It.
See, these are the things that bring us joy in these times, man.
Yeah.
Sorry for everybody listening to this. You're missing out here, but it's worth
are
it.
Are we already live?
Well, I put it all in, yeah, but this will only be on audio form. So really, this is at this stage just for my enjoyment.
Can I even drag something into the chat? I don't think I can. Anyway.
I love it. Well, good to meet you, man. Good to meet you and the Fat yeah. Beatles. What a backing band.
Good to meet you, too.
What's going on? Are you back in Toronto? I've been chatting to your colleague, Ali.
My wife and I were in LA for 8 years and then moved back to until we had a kid in January. And then, you know, the there was a lot of compounded issues with Los Angeles, given the current state of affairs. So we decided to move back in the summer and made our way back in the fall. And then we haven't really been, I'm saying this because you said Toronto. We haven't really been in Toronto. We were in the burbs where we both grew up, living with family, and then we bought a house in the boonies, like 2 hours, 2.5 hours northwest of the city, in a village. So that's what we're doing now, village life.
Well, it's funny. Totally, everybody totally I know different. Has been doing the same thing. I'm doing the same thing. I'm in the house where I grew up. I was in London till August, and I'm like a DJ by craft, if you can call it that. That's where I make the majority of my income. And so obviously, like yourself and everybody else in this industry, my income was ripped out with this thing. So I did a couple of months and, you know, scringed and scraped by. And then, it got to summer and I was like, what's the point in paying, you know, extortionate London, or in your case, LA rent, as much as anything, like when everything's shut, all the things that make those cities special are currently shut. And I guess with LA in particular, I've got a few friends who left last year. It was just, by all accounts, like madness out there, right? With the protests and everything as well added to it all, it just looked like a fucking post-apocalyptic wasteland from the outside looking in.
there were a lot of layers. You know, you live there because it's beautiful and there's opportunity and there's stuff to do and there's restaurants and there's all this stuff, just culture, you know, in a metropolis. And the wildness of a city, you know, you like to, especially after a certain age, you like to keep it at bay. I remember when we lived in Toronto, a friend of mine and I bought a house in this neighborhood that was, you know, we were kind of the whatever battalion of the gentrification, the artists and musicians are. We were like that battalion where it's still kind of rough and you can buy things for cheap, well, for what you can afford, not for cheap, because it was expensive, but for us. But we bought a house and built a recording studio. But the neighborhood was still, you know, it was pretty rough.
Whereabouts were you in LA?
No, I'm talking about Toronto now. This is a number of years back. But all this to say that we were, you know, it was this neighborhood that's in transition between two eras. And I was walking one night, and there was a couple who had just eaten in this really chic restaurant that just popped up. You know, and their car window was smashed, and they're like, "How could this happen? You know, we read a review of this restaurant in this such and such magazine, and how could this happen? Because this is the city." Because yeah, that's what happens in the city.
Frontline gentrification, isn't it? As you say, where the two worlds are harmoniously sometimes, but sometimes even not harmoniously coexisting.
Yeah, it's a funny balance. You know, when we moved into that neighborhood, you know, you move in because you can afford it, you've got space, and you can make some noise. And then the next battalion that comes in, they're like, "It's too noisy here." Like, yep. Get these musicians out of here.
Well, that's how you get venues closing down and pubs is, you know, they put up the high rise flats next to these, you know, historical venues or like cool bars. And originally and you know, initially it's like, "Oh, this is a hip area. Let's move here." And then they're like, "Oh no, we want to make it residential now. We want to take away what makes it cool and make it safe and sound." And then you rip the heart out of the thing.
We played like that though, aren't they? I have a song on my second solo record, that the chorus is, "If the city don't change, if the city don't grow, where will the new people go?" But if there's a constant turnaround, and actually, you know, as controversial as gentrification is as like a topic, no one can argue that there's a fine balance, you know, in those neighborhoods and the people. It's like, you know, if we're speaking specifically about this neighborhood in Toronto that I was living in, it was culturally, you know, split kind of Portuguese and Vietnamese. And they both had, you know, their businesses, but the businesses that were you know, maybe not as reluctant to the slight shift that was happening demographically, they did really well. And they're still there. There's this Vietnamese restaurant, called Golden Turtle in that neighborhood that just, and there's another one down the street, but I was a Golden Turtle guy. But that family that runs the restaurant, they just loved it. You know, the neighborhood, people were coming in, people were eating out every night. The family was going to Vegas, you know, 3-4 times a year, and they'd come back with bling. And we'd watch the kids grow up. And, you know, and the Portuguese baker in the corner, same thing, you know, they did well. And if you roll with it, you know, no one there can argue that it was a bad thing that suddenly families are moving in and things like that. Of course, it gets to that point. You know, one of our first shows in New York, or maybe like third or fourth show early on, we played this venue called the Knitting Factory, which is a famous venue. And I was as a young man kind of obsessed with Jeff Buckley, and it was part of his lore. And for me to get to play that venue was incredible. And it was one of those things where there was a hard curfew, there was a decibel limit, and you're in the middle of this neighborhood that, you know, you're loading out your gear, and there's a woman in Givenchy walking her dog into an entrance to the doorman. And you could tell that moment in time was about to tip one way, you know.
I mean, this is the stuff of life for me. I find it fascinating. And, you know, the last year has been so challenging for so many reasons, but I'm not even in a curious way, just in a, well, it's going to happen this way, but to see how the world will change coming out of this, especially cities. You know, they've changed so much in this thing, but they haven't really changed so much as just been like, hit, like pause has been hit. Do you know what I mean? The shutters have come down, but the flux has sort of stopped for the last 12 months and it's just been static. Yeah. And I'm going to be fascinated to see moving forward how it all begins to, you know, either rapidly change or, I mean, it just blows my mind, this whole experience.
Yeah, I mean, I had a bit of a fear living in Los Angeles, where we lived in Silver Lake, which is, you know, pretty chill neighborhood.
Nice neighborhood.
And great neighborhood. And we had an amazing apartment that we never intended on leaving. You know, we intended on paying rent there forever because it was so beautiful. And the view was of downtown. So you just saw the LA skyline, which is became very Blade Runner-esque, especially after a very tense summer. And
you had the fires as well, didn't you?
The fires. And we were in a helicopter route. So it was just basically choppers just buzzing the sky.
Just constant.
All night long, constantly. And until about July 4th, I think July 4th was a bit of a cathartic moment for LA, but and usually is, just because they just start blowing shit up. But there were fireworks, intense fireworks, and explosions every night and sirens. It was super intense. But watching the skyline, I kept thinking, how long before the commercial real estate situation, you know, before these people, whoever they are, these financial groupings that buy these massive buildings and fill them with businesses, you know, how long before the rug's pulled out underneath them and they start defaulting? And what happens when a city's buildings drain out of tenancy? You know, what happens then? What happens when that big shiny thing, all those obelisks become vacant? I just had this weird, you know, this very, especially living in LA, it's very Blade Runner. It can get very Blade Runner at times. It got pretty Blade Runner, and I thought, you know what? I don't want to see this through.
Yeah, and obviously with a daughter on the way. Is it a daughter, sorry, you said, or a son?
Yeah, daughter. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, with a child, full stop, on the way, that's kind of the last place you want to be. Do you think you'd have felt differently if that wasn't the case, if it was just you and your wife? Would you have stuck around to see how that situation panned out, do you think? I know it's a hypothetical question, but...
It's possible. There was also a great sense that we were just basically consumers. Because the future was so opaque, we didn't know when we'd be able to work again. And, you know, I just spent a year making a record. I wasn't making any money. I was just spending, you know, spending money, making a record.
Was this the Death From Above album or a solo album? Or?
Yeah, Death From Above album. Yeah. So
is that self-finance, was it?
No, it wasn't self-finance, but...
you got no income because you're not touring, etc.
We're not touring, and you know, I took on the most of the work of production and mixing and all that stuff. And so, until that was off my plate, I couldn't, you know, go out into the world and do anything to make money. So, yeah, just for me, because I took on that role, it created a bit of a ditch in my finances, which is totally
income
fine.
Freezes, yep.
Yeah, it freezes, and when you're expecting to go and fill that ditch up, you know, once the thing's out in the world, then it's different. But then we ended up sitting on the record for another year. So yeah, it got to a point where you feel like you're on vacation. You know, and you're living in LA, the weather's incredible, the view's great. You're on vacation, but kind of, you know, nothing's open. You can't really do anything. Mm-hmm. There was that. And then, so I don't know if that would have been different without the child, but with the child, with all the travel restrictions, we were just, she wasn't getting any contact from people, you know, and we weren't able to see our family. And so, you know, your priorities shift in that sense. You want to, incorporate your family and people into the kid's life. So yeah, made the tough call, but also the second we decided to do that, the future became far less opaque, because we took action, you know, and we made goals for ourselves. But that was a very strange thing. I'm not like a goal setting type person, but being in the field I'm in, there's even though rock and roll is a bit precarious in general, you know, there's a bit of a sense of security. Like I know that I can make a record and go out and play some shows. And I'm not talking about in a careerist way, but just knowing the future is kind of knowable, you know?
I can completely relate. You know that there's, you know, in some way you can hustle an income. You know that you have the tools and the skill set and the community of people around you to get out there and bring home the bacon.
And not even that. Just the, you know, having something to do, you know, something, a purpose in life and something that has great meaning to you. Knowing that that is in your future it's just, you get used to it. And then without having that reassurance, you know, it was a very strange feeling. I'm sure, you know, many, many people can relate. You just could not see the future. There's no way to see it. And so us taking action, moving back to Ontario, we ultimately buying an old house, which is a Pandora's box of things to do. Mm-hmm. There's no lack of, you know, there's no lack of things.
Well, there's something to be said as well, man, for like moving back to where you grew up to bring up a family. Like, you know, it's that cycle of life, isn't it? And reconnecting and starting again. And, you know, it all feeds into it. And I know so many friends that have returned to sort of the areas where they grew up over this time, or even before the pandemic, when they're thinking about starting a family, they want to be near their parents because, you know, you want the grandparents around. And there's just something about it. Is your wife from Canada as well? Where's she from?
She grew up here. She grew up in the same suburb I grew up in, but she was born in South Africa from Polish parents. So very much, very much Polish, culturally. And
your dad was English, right?
My dad's English. Yeah. Yeah.
So you got it all going on.
Got it all. My mother's French Canadian and my father's Brit. And then we've got the hard Polish situation.
Amazing. Have you been out to Poland a lot?
We go out, we try to go out, you know, at least every couple of years to see, my wife's father's, went back there a number of years ago and started a new family. So we go out there to visit him and all of her aunts and uncles and stuff. I love it.
Whereabouts is it? They're based. Where are they?
Kind of near the Czech border up in, like Bratislava and,
been there, yeah. Yeah.
Kaspatch and
spelt rock claw, right?
Yeah, rock claw, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I did a month in Poland like 12 or 13 years ago. And I just and we went like everywhere. We did like Gdańsk, Rzeszów, Lublin, Toruń, all over, not just Warsaw and Krakow. And yeah, we went to rock claw and just had the best time. The food's amazing, the people are super cool. We went there in the dead of winter, so it was just like covered in snow everywhere we went. Mm-hmm. An amazing country.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Big fan.
And still, the first time I went there, it was kind of still, it felt like before H&M had arrived, you know? So, the style palette was still very much a unique thing. It was still, this is only in a matter of a few years, but the feeling was that it was still very much like Eastern Europe, you know? And I was, you know, wearing skinny jeans and cool, you know, jean jacket and, whatever. You know, I was like,
hip. You would have been turning heads, is what would have been.
I was getting called very specific names in the town square from men cropped hair and football jerseys.
Well, so. That's the thing. The guys out there, you would not want to mess with them, man. They're a different breed of tough.
Yeah. That said, 2 years later, I went back and it was just like everyone was wearing skinny jeans and had emo hair. So, yeah.
Yeah. They're like, hey, there's that guy. He was the first one, the trendsetter.
Yeah. There he is. It's like the god returns.
Buy him a gyro.
Yeah.
Exactly. Dude, I want to jump in on this brand new record of yours. I'm loving talking to you, man. It's already a joy. So thank you for coming on the show. Is for lovers. So I was looking at the origin of this term because I thought it was this. Are you familiar with the history of it as you know, the kind of marketing tourist travel slogan for Virginia?
Yeah. Well, it's definitely it incepted its way into my mind. My father, the business he was in, the American counterpart to his Canadian business was in Virginia, was in Virginia Beach. So we would go there every summer, and because it was a write-off, we could sit in a hotel on the beach for very, very cheap for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks while my father continued to work. I thought I was, you know, I didn't quite know how it popped into my mind, but I'm sure it was that.
Yeah. It's that kind of subconscious thing, right? And it's funny because it's obviously now a term which is part of like colloquial phrasing. And it's one of the few, like there's so many sort, I guess I would call them like internet phrases, right? It's one of the few that I really like. A lot of them just annoy me because they just, I don't know, they reek of insincerity. And I think a lot of people nowadays kind of use this language that, you know, used to actually mean something in quite detached, ironic ways, if that makes sense. I don't really know whether I'm explaining it well, but, you know, like, for instance, a phrase like, I'm here for it. People like to say that now, I'm here for it. I'm here for it.
Sure.
Yeah, but I doubt you'd actually be here for it if, it, you know, the crunch kind of kept, crunch time.
Yeah. One of them that I heard recently that I started to review how many times people have used it on me, and I'm going, maybe they're condescending to me the whole time. It's this phrase, my dude, like, what's up, my dude? And like, blah, 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 my dude. You know, it's almost like the clap back emoji.
You know, drives me mad. That's another one.
I thought it was kind of a fraternal or, you know, whatever it is, an inclusive term or whatever, but it feels really much like condescension. You know, there's a moment, I kind of got sick of irony, and I try to, you know, I'm still infected with it. It's hard to shake, but there's something so cynical about it. And this kind of postmodern irony that I thought was cool for so many years, you know, and with the all due respect, you know, it's kind of a Julian Casablancas style of, frontman irony, which I got a great kick out of for many years, where, you know, you'd see him at a festival and he'd go, so you guys like music, you know, you guys like music, like kind of taking a piss out of the audience for attending a festival for, you know, 3 or 4 days and just watching bands and bands and bands and bands. And that's kind of a nightmare for a musician, to just like watch bands all day. So him being on stage saying, you like music, he's not saying like, music is great, don't we love music, he's saying, ha ha ha,
yeah,
why would you love music, you know, this kind of weird postmodern irony that like I said, I used to get quite a kick out of, and I still do to a certain extent, but there's something just so cynical about it.
When that movement that you're talking about happened, I think there was, you know, it was a reaction to what had come before, as everything is, right? And so at that time, I think there was this sort of sarcastic cynicism there, but it was also from an authentic place. Whereas now I feel like the authenticity isn't so much there. And so it's kind of cynical and detached and like ironic, but then it's like, but then the passion isn't there, and they're not passionate about That's what I feel like. And I don't know whether I just sound like a grumpy old man saying that, but
yeah,
I just,
we're allowed to be grumpy old man.
Yeah. Well, we're getting there, right? We're getting there.
100%. Once you see it, once you see the thing go around a few times and you start to see the, you start to see through it a bit. You know, that's, I think part of our job, as humans that maybe comment on culture or observe culture or engage in it, participate, you need to keep it healthy. It needs to be, light needs to be, you know, shined on it. And you can't really, you're so in it when you're 20, you can't possibly see it for what it is. So you need the guy that's double 20 that's still in it to go, wait a second. Yeah. But also, I don't know, we were recording this thing a few weeks ago, and there was an engineer in the studio with us, and he was 22 or 24. And instantly Jesse and I are just giving him all kinds of advice. But it's like, believe me, I wanted a cool guy like me to go back into, like, if I could, you know, the whole phrase, you know, what would you tell yourself if you, you know, your 20-year-old self, you had the opportunity to go back in time. It's like, you know, that happens because old guys will often tell young guys, you should do this, this, and this. That's actually you in the future coming back to tell you, you know?
Yeah, very Bill and Ted-esque. I never had that, and I'd love it. I mean, I'm always drawn towards older people, always have been my whole life, more so than people, even my own age, let alone younger. You know, I can never really be bothered to hang around with anybody younger than me. I just don't have the patience for it and never did. But there's always wisdom to be imparted. I want to quickly backtrack a second. Mm-hmm. Are you someone, because obviously I know just from like your music and hearing you in interviews and seeing the Fat Beatles behind you, you obviously have a great you have a great sense of humor. And it's hard sometimes because I think you can mix sincerity and being real with obviously taking mm-hmm. the piss as well. And yeah, I wanted to just backtrack on that because you were sort of talking about the whole irony thing, which is in you and you know, unshakably so. Mm-hmm. Over time, how's that evolved in yourself?
Well, if I can contextualize it to the band, when we started, you know, it was either, you know, small kind of punk shows or a little bit later on opening for bigger bands. And we're a weird band. We've remained a weird band and we have a weird sound. And especially at the beginning, you know, I mean, we're still way too loud. That's part of the thing. But we need to defend ourselves. And we were kind of going into battle at every show. And especially when there's proximity to the audience, there's kind of like, you're a threat to them, they're a threat to you. If you're opening for a bigger band and we come on first and they're expecting, you know, whatever it is, My Chemical Romance or Billy Talent or whomever we open for, and they get us, maybe it's not what they want. So we were, you know, my humor was defensive. We were combative. And then when we would play, it was just like heads down playing very aggressively. And that was kind of a survival tactic. And as that evolved, and it didn't take that long for this to happen, but whatever humor exists on stage in the banter, it's meant as an inside joke. It's like, we're all, whatever the parameter of the room is that we're playing, like this is the party and we're all part of it. So if I'm saying some nonsense on the microphone, primarily it's to make Jesse laugh. And then, but also to create a sense of like, let's have a laugh together, you know, let's enjoy this space and together. And I'm never trying to, even when I'm calling someone out in the audience, I'm not really trying to
be mean-spirited.
You know, yeah. It's like I've seen that happen too. You know, we've all seen footage of poison tongue musicians call out audience members in a way that maybe they never recover from.
Yeah. Be they innocent or not, right? There's sort of like a line you can maybe go to and still retain that sense of like friendly and approachableness. And then there's full on like, whoa, I wouldn't be fucking heckling that guy after what I've just seen.
Yeah. But there's also, it's dangerous, you know, because we're not comedians and music isn't comedy. And I think there's, you know, there's like this weird symbiosis between musicians and comedians that, you know, I don't want to say I've gotten into trouble, but, you know, I've definitely gone on tangents live where I've felt like I've had the permission of a George Carlin. But I'm like, I'm not Richard Pryor. I'm not George Carlin. I don't have those credentials.
Well, and it's not scripted either, right? It's in the moment. And so
it's in the moment. Yeah.
The joke doesn't always land. And yeah, as you say, you might lose track of the thought process might get away from you. And it's real. It's like improv. And that, even if you're a comedian, improv can either work or not, right? And so if you're not a professional comedian, you're taking a gamble.
I mean, some of my most proud moments in music are when something joke-wise really lands. Like I've had a few where it was just, I started a thought and I went on a rant that lasted, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, and there was a punchline at the end, and then we kick into a song and it's like people are like going crazy with laughter, and then they're so excited about the song. Like maybe if I listened to it back, it would have been a terrible joke, but for some reason it really worked in the moment, you know, and my memory of it is this transcendent comedy genius. It's probably sucked, but I don't want to review it. It's like,
well, dude, nothing punctuates a thought or a speech better than a song. Like I used to work in radio, and you know, the idea of like in the link, you're going down a certain street with what you're saying, and then at the end of it, you reach the conclusion of that, you know, sentence or paragraph or idea, bang, punctuate it with, you know, a strong intro to a wicked tune. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. And then people, as you say, they're like, oh, this fucking song's awesome. And they appreciate and enjoy it that much more because the lead-in has led them right up to that sweet spot.
Yeah, we were doing we're doing quite a bit of radio right now. And we did a morning show, you know, like this morning zoo with three or four different hosts and us. And one of the guys is just that personality where he's like, everything is a segue and everything is a punchline or just like perfectly timed, you know? It's such a skill. It's incredible to have that skill. I mean, that's the skill of a comedian or an orator. You know, you're able to read the room, follow the conversation, absorb whatever heckles are happening, and then come out with a definitive wow.
Yep.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mean Streets, dude. I think one of my favorite introductions in cinematic history is Robert De Niro as Johnny Boy as he enters that bar. The camera pans down in slow motion. Jumping Jack Flash is playing. He's got a woman under each arm. Bam. Such an iconic moment in cinema. I love that you reference that in Mean Streets. Are you a big De Niro or indeed 70s movie fan? What's the thought process and inspiration there?
Definitely, yeah, big fan of film and 70s film and Scorsese and, you know, De Niro up until at least Heat.
Yeah, there you go. Before he starts doing Meet the Fuckers and Anger Management.
All that stuff is fine as well, but, you know, he's still like cool and got a good body and whatever looks cool, you know.
Did you watch The Irishman?
I did. Yeah, it's funny.
He's trying to beat up the guy at the convenience store.
I know.
It's like
and
the
he's
most
got
unconvincing fight scene ever.
It's insane. I mean, the thing with like they keep patting themselves on the back for this technology that made Robert De Niro maybe 7 years younger. You know, it's not like they're like calling him kid. It's like, dude, you're literally seven. You've got a, I don't know, like a 6.5% wrinkle reduction.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, your body is stiff.
And he's got like weird, his eye tone was different as well. Like the eyes went blue. They both did. I mean, it was all right, but the kind of hype that movie got, I was like,
I enjoyed it. I didn't like how they were trying to convince us of one thing, but I liked it. You know, I watched it.
Harvey Keitel was the best part about that film for me. He was fucking great in his little part.
I don't think he's ever been bad in anything. Yeah, I love those movies. Mean Streets specifically, you know, in the context of this song is another thing. It was kind of incepted. And it was just a kind of a free association song, clearly, because I went and inserted a Bad Brains or Crass song in the middle of it. I just kind of let that song flow out of me. And so lyrically, you know, I haven't even watched Mean Streets in maybe 15 or 20 years. So, and yeah, I probably should watch it now that we've got a song called Mean Streets. I should probably go back.
Well, it's like the Virginia thing,
again.
Right? It's just percolating. And you must, you know, as an artist, everybody has those things, right? That are just, you see something and it makes an impression on you. And, you know, maybe it doesn't get used for two decades or whatever. And then one day it just fits with where your head's at. It's interesting you say Crass. I went to one of the coolest things I've done, and I want to go back soon when it's a bit safer too. But Penny Rambeau from Crass lives out on this beautiful little commune, like the original commune where they all started the band and stuff.
Yeah,
I went out there to spend the day with him to record one of these, and it was just the most blissful, peaceful, amazing place I've been. We spent all day talking about Werner Herzog films, and he's like, "You got to come back, man." We didn't say man, but he said you should come back sometime. And it's been something I've been wanting to do, but obviously he's of a certain age, and the last thing you want to be doing at this moment in time is being around, you know, older people. But
sneezing on an old man.
What a spot. Were they an important band for you growing up, like artistically?
No, not
or ideologically.
Not growing up. No, none of those things. They're a band that my wife loves, so I looked into them so that she would think I was cooler.
hey, but man. We all just want to be loved.
I developed a real strong love of a number of their songs, and definitely their energy and their aesthetic is incredible. I'm not putting them on every day, but you know, like I said, at first I listened to them so that my wife thought I was cool.
And did it work?
I mean, she thinks I'm all right.
She stuck around. We're having a family together. Things are going.
Yeah, we've been together for 16 years or whatever. So
amazing.
She thinks I'm cool enough.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, we have this little. My wife had a magazine for many years, and we would attend the New York Art Book Fair or LA Art Book Fair. And at some point we picked up this book about Penny Rimbaud, like a little biography. And it's sitting on my kids' bookshelf. And every now and then I turn around, she's reading about Penny Rimbaud, just like,
He's a very wise man. He's got some amazing records where it's just him reading like Wilfred Owen war poetry over strings and really emotive music, and he's got this great, rich, deep voice. It's
what I love about that. Interesting lesson. About him, you know, he's certainly evolved into this sage, and maybe he always was, but from my understanding, you know, he was kind of the rich boy in Crass.
Steve Ignorant's very much the working class guy, and Penny's almost like the hippie, like the kind of posh middle class hippie.
But I forget where I heard this, maybe it was a documentary about them or something, but mentioning that, you know, the drummer is always kind of has to be kind of well off because he needs to A, afford a drum kit, or he or she, and B, have the space to make that kind of noise, you know. I can relate to that somewhat. I grew up in the suburbs, but in a semi-detached house. So anytime I hit a drum, I was brutalizing somebody. So I was always kind of very self-conscious about the amount of noise I was making, because I wasn't being told to shut up, but certainly there were people banging on walls and floors around me. So, yeah.
How about your other partner? How long have you guys been knocking around together now, you and Jesse?
It's been about 20 years. We met in 2000. The first time we played, he was still living with his parents out in the east suburbs of Toronto. And the first time we played together, he invited me to his house, his parents' house. And he had a jam room in the basement. His father was a musician as well. So there's tons of gear, and he had this concept for a band where he tuned his guitar down to a B, like the E string was down to a low B. So it was this like really floppy, drony sound. And he had all these crazy amps that he plugged in, and he was playing, and it was the loudest thing I'd ever heard. And he kept telling me to play louder and harder. He was like, harder, harder, hit harder. And I, until that point, you know, I'd never played in that way. I'd never tried to hit that hard. I was like, hey, listen to this ghost note. You know, it's like no ghosts. It's like pure zombie, fully materialized human monsters. We're literally knocking things off the wall upstairs. Like, we went upstairs and his mom was kind of dusting plates off that had fallen off and picking things up. And she didn't seem too bothered by it. She's a pretty, pretty stern and domineering woman, but also kind of understood that maybe her insane son needed, you know, at least part of what he was doing down there to remain sane. I can vouch for that. I know that he needs to be loud.
He always had a wild energy about him, did he? Was he always like kind of plugged into something?
Yeah, he's a wild person. Yeah. He's definitely he's in theory mellowed out. You know, having two daughters, I think he developed a great deal of patience, which maybe he didn't have so much of before, and more compassion and understanding. But he's still an insane person, as like measured and balanced as he appears to be.
Yeah. He can just control it now.
Yeah. And also, I mean, it's been good for me as an artist because I take more time with things. I need more time with music and art. And I need to have a lot of personal time with it. And we're at a point where we trust each other kind of to a fault. And this record is an experiment in how much we did trust each other, because we made the music in about 5 weeks together in a room. And I just got as much of him as I could on tape. And on laptop. Actually, this laptop I'm using now is the whole record is made on this thing. So, I got as much out of him as possible. And then I took that and turned it into Is for Lovers over the course of a number of months. And he really had to trust me. And, but also, you know, I had to trust him that he's going to give me something out of his fingers that will inspire me to do the next thing and push it all the way up the hill. So our roles in the band are far more well defined now than they ever have been, and it's a really good balance for me, you know, right now. Yeah, it's very good.
I love the album, man. And, you know, it's funny because whenever a band goes out to talk about a new record, obviously they're going to say, this is the best thing we've ever done. You know, because I don't think any band's going to go, the first album was actually the best we did. And then this is like the fourth best. But check it out anyway. But this is my favorite album you guys have done. I think you sound as complete, like the whole aesthetic that you've always had, I think just sounds as well realized on this record as any that have come before it. I think you sound like you're fucking honing and firing from all cylinders. You know, and everything is like dialed in to the best of its ability. And I just think the songwriting's amazing. The performances are great. The energy's great. I thoroughly enjoy it, man. I've listened to it like 5 or 6 times ahead of chatting to you today. And every time there's like new things to appreciate. And big fan, dude. I think you've done a great job with it.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree. There's actually a Scorsese related anecdote that I like to add to this kind of comment. Where I saw, why am I always forgetting, blanking on this guy's name? I'm going to sound like an idiot, but the actor in Goodfellas,
Ray Liotta.
Ray Liotta. Yeah. So Ray Liotta, you know, I'm betraying myself by forgetting his name, but I love
Goodfellas.
It's all good.
The story's still going to be killer.
Yeah. There's nothing not to love about Goodfellas, but I saw Ray Liotta on a late night talk show a number of years ago, and he was promoting, some Christmas film where, there was some, you know, computer generated snowman involved, and I think maybe he was that snowman. I'm not sure. He was definitely a father in a nice brick house in this film, and he went on a late night talk show and he had the gall to say that it was maybe the best thing he'd ever done. I'm thinking, dude, there's no way that's true, and there's no way that you believe that. Very difficult to believe that's true. So I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be Ray Liotta. But that said, it's definitely the record that, you know, personally, I was the most involved in. Even the first LP we made, I didn't know anything about recording. You know, I knew about 4-track cassette recording, but I didn't know about a studio. We made most of it in a after hours in this great studio in Toronto that doesn't exist. That's now a condominium. It got torn down not long. It was a studio called Chemical Sound. It was in an alley behind a strip club in Amazing. Toronto. And when we were kind of between takes or having a cigarette, sometimes the strippers would be out back in the alley having a cigarette too. And you'd kind of like commiserate, like, you know, it's a workaday world, you know, just another day on the job. And yeah, that place is now condominiums. But we recorded there after hours because our buddy Al, who made that record with us, he worked there.
He did the first full length as well, right?
Yeah. This is what I'm referring to. And because we were concerned with, you know, maybe damaging equipment or, you know, I wasn't allowed near the console. I couldn't even breathe over it. So I would kind of stay at the back of the room, and when it came time to mix the record, I just had no ability or knowledge of how to do that. And so I kind of, you know, I stepped back at that point. Extremely proud of that record, and it's unarguably I'll just say it, it's a great record, and it's a document of that time. It's a record of that time. But as far as like exercising a full creative vision, this would be the record that actually happened on. For me, it's like the hyper Death Row Above record, because we were not influenced by any outside sources, and there were no voices telling us to fix anything or change anything or suggesting anything, really. It was really just kind of a heads down, follow instinct, like go basically autistic in the studio, with, you know, a level of obsession and passion and love and focus that you can only do, I can only do really, like, when I'm left on my own.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah. And, you know, I think that you've obviously worked with some incredible people and had the chance to observe and learn from them. And then it's almost like when you're left unsupervised with this kind of skill set that you've amassed along the way, that's when you can just lose yourself in, you know, the absolute craft of it and bring what you really want to see in your head to life.
Yeah. There's something, I'm a, you know, pretty sensitive person and generally pretty polite, and when I'm in a room with somebody, when we're making music, I'm not that assertive, because I'll give the other person the benefit of the doubt, let's say. So
and when there's only two of you, that can obviously present problems, right?
Well, Jesse and I, it's a non-issue. We're, you know, our dynamic is pretty secure, and there's nothing that he can offer that won't be, you know, received by me or vice versa. I'm speaking more when we're working with an outside producer, you know.
Got you.
And as you said, it was a great privilege to work with Dave Sardi and Eric Valentine. And I learned an insane amount from working with Eric. The nature of my role in the band is I have to spend a lot more time with these guys because, you know, there's some songwriting, there's singing, there's takes, there's blah, 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 you know. And also I lived in Los Angeles and Jesse was still in Toronto. So he would fly in for his part and then I would remain for the rest of it. And, but like, let's say we're trying to come up with some cool thing for verse two, you want to add something, blah, 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 blah. Knowing that these people are such strong writers, and I mean, Eric Valentine's an incredible musician. Amazing guy. But to be able to actually write, if we were in the same room together, I would have to leave the room. I couldn't sit there in the room and like work it out because. The nature of my personality, I probably just go, oh, yeah, that's good, dude. And then we, you know, his thing would get on the record. So I would like, if we had to do something, I would go, okay, and get a guitar and go in the next room. Or, you know, this is how much of a privilege it was, go in the next room and write something on Stevie Wonder's piano.
Wow.
Because that's what was there.
So that happened.
So that happened. Yeah. Most of the melodies on Outrageous Now were written sitting at that piano. I would have my laptop up on this grand piano up on top of it. And I would sit there with this track playing and singing something out and then trying to figure out melodically what would be better and playing on the piano and recording it into the speaker of my laptop. And then going into this little vocal booth it was a guitar booth that was built for Slash. It's called Slash House. And I would go into Slash House and then sing it out through the laptop. Mic and then see if it worked, you know. So like kind of muck about with voice and piano, figure it out on the piano, record on piano, try it in voice, bring it out on my laptop, play it for Eric and Jesse if he was there and see if it works. If it works, you know, turn the mic on and do it for real. And that was that's a really great process too. I wouldn't ever trade that in. Insane experience to have had. But my formative years in making music was borrowing a four track from a friend or the school I went to, and then just sitting there all night making music and multi-tracking the sound of, you know, being able to double my voice or do a vocal harmony or something. Like the four track was a almost psychedelic experience for me when I discovered it. And then staying up all night, either alone or with friends, making a thing and then listening to it 20 or 30 times and falling asleep and then waking up and listening to it. And this kind of obsessive, I don't know, just this, whatever it is, it's that spirit of creating in a vacuum to the point of exhaustion is my natural state artistically.
I get so, it, man. Yeah. Hyper focus, isn't it?
Yeah. And so this is the record where I was able to do that, go back to that mode and just sit in a room with something for as long as I needed to and obsess over it, but not in a way that was, not in a way that where anything was really ironed out, I don't think, because you can, if you overwork something, you can ruin it. And that's not the case with this record. I don't think it's overwork. It's just, I don't know. There's a level of detail in it that I was able to achieve that can only achieve in the darkness, I think.
Well, yeah, it's a beautiful untamed beast. You know, just because it sounds great, it doesn't mean that it's like structured in that sort of formulaic sense. It's not that. It's everything you'd want a Death From Above album to be. You know, it's wild, it's untamed, it's unpredictable, it's raucous. It just happens to sound fantastic as well. I love it, dude. We got to wrap there. The hour's up. I could talk to you all day. Hopefully we can do one of these in person one day. Want to ask you this, yeah, to finish off. Is that a Rumblefish tattoo on your arm? Is that a reference to that, Rusty James?
Yeah, Rusty James. Yeah.
Hell yeah.
I've got the
motorcycle boy.
Where is he? There he is.
Fuck yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I got these done in London, actually. Yeah, I got them done in London.
What a movie. Mickey Rourke, dude, is my number one dream podcast guest. He's my favorite actor of all time.
Yeah, he's incredible. Yeah, this movie had a huge, huge impact on me, massive impact on me. Yeah, so I keep it close. Yeah.
I love it. I've loved talking to you, Sebastian. Thanks for your time.
Likewise.
Man.
Yeah,
thanks for the music. Thanks for stimulating conversation. And yeah, man, all the best. Congratulations on a great record, great career, and I hope that we can have a beer and do this in person one day in the new world.
At any time.
You take care, dude. Have a great day.
Okay. See you, bud. Thank you.
See you in a bit. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.